previously.tvpodcastnetwork.
It's totally worrisome, but... Yeah, well, no, there's no but. It is totally worrisome.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 138 for the week of December 12th, 2016. I am vegetarian alternative David T. Cole, and I'm here with pretentious slaw Sarah D. Bunting.
Go to hell, big cabbage.
Pickled raisin tar Ariano.
I shouldn't exist.
Raisin is a crucial food of Extra Hot Great. And missing biscuit Jeff Drake.
So I didn't inspire you to make biscuits.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Extra Hot Great, episode 138. We are joined today by our esteemed colleague, Jeff Drake, to talk about Top Chef. But
esteemed?
First,
esteemed.
Well, we'll soon fix that. Welcome back, Jeff Drake. Thank you for joining us for our discussion of Top Chef and other cooking shows about which I will be slightly less inept, I hope.
Well, it's very good to be back and to see that this is running as smoothly as ever. And that
you are indeed our top Jeff.
I am the top Jeff. No, it's good to be back. I'm actually kind of excited about this season of Top Chef.
All right, so you cover it for us on previously.tv, of course, which is why you are here. Tell us about the season so far. There's been two episodes, and now it's set in Charleston. What do you think about this setting? Sorry, I should specify. Charleston, South Carolina, not Charleston, West Virginia, with the contaminated water. This is the one that isn't killing people. Continue.
No, it's simply the one steeped in racism. So so there's that they've already had to deal with a little bit, because they had a... I'm getting ahead of myself, but they had, you know, the finale, sort of the elimination challenge in the very first episode was set in basically a former plantation, and it was a white guy versus a black guy. So that was a good choice by the producers. So that aside, like, at first I was like, Charleston, South Carolina, you know, I was like, oh yeah, like everybody everywhere is talking about, like, wow, you've got to go to Charleston, South Carolina and try the food. But I mean, it's like anywhere that they set Top Chef. It's like, you know, they set it in DC, and it's not like people around the country are like, oh my God, I need to go to DC and try the food. So I've heard that they set it in places where they've had like lower ratings or whatever to try to boost local interest. But then by the second episode, it's like, oh, okay, it's obvious that there is some sort of like a renaissance going on. But I don't know that it's any more or less than like in most cities where there's like this very like craft and farm to table and all of that stuff. I feel like that's sort of happening everywhere, but at least it seems like it's going on. So it seems true enough for a reality show.
Yeah.
You know, which is a low bar. I think we can all agree that true enough for a reality show is not really a heavy stake to put on something.
I mean, yeah, you're right. It seems like that fancy food is the kind of thing that happens in probably any medium size or larger city if you just look. But I feel like the racial stuff is bigger than you're talking about, because it comes up in the second episode too, where the premise of this season is that there's a bunch of rookies who've never been on the show before, and then they've brought back a bunch of veterans as well who've participated in previous seasons but not won, I believe. There aren't any winners in the mix, right?
No. Okay. There's at least one second place finisher.
Okay. So for the first like real challenge, they divide into like a rookie team and a vet team, and they go and each have a meal at a local chef's home where they talk about, you know, they teach them dishes that are part of like the tradition that they cook in and stuff. And the one guy's went into Gullah, the Gullah tradition of cooking. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's it's essentially like a culture and a type of cooking that came from West Africa, and it came over with the slaves. And I mean, it actually precedes, you know, it was in West Africa before it came over to the States. And I know only what I read on Wikipedia, so I don't know a lot about it.
Yeah.
So there's a guy who, I forget his name, BJ Dennis, I believe is his name. And he's kind of, he used to be like, he used to have like pop-ups and stuff in Charleston, but he's since just become an ambassador for this type of cooking and culture. And so it's very, you know, it's like a, it, it's like a soul food type take on stuff. And it's very, like with Charleston, there's a lot of focus on, the types of food that you can get, the way the ocean is right there, there's just a lot of seafood that you can't get in a lot of other places. So there's right. a lot of, you know, shrimp and oysters and just all, it's just a very bountiful sort of ocean harvest there. And so the Gullah stuff is West African take on this, local stuff. And so, so yeah, it's, you know, and then the veterans, that was the, no wait, that was the veterans, and the rookies went to
the biscuit lady.
This white lady who's famous for her biscuits. You know, and it's like both are interesting takes, but it is like in the context of the show, it is like, oh, okay, so which cuisine wins out? Is it the black version of the local food, or right. is it the white version of the local food?
Yeah.
And that they're often obligated to ask the chef testants in so many words, like, how are you feeling about the racial overtones of the location in which we're cooking today? Like,
yeah.
I felt really bad for that first guy who was eliminated, who on top of like having to do a sudden death cook-off also had to explain how fucked up he was, that he was on the, you know, right. an antebellum plantation. Like,
yeah,
exactly. There,
many people died and were enslaved. Like, it's just a cooking show. Like, what are we doing here?
Exactly. Yeah, and then on the other side of that, then John Tizar, who is the guy that the white chef he was up against, was like, I feel in a similar fashion. And it's like, I don't want to hear anything that you say after that. Like, I know you're just trying to be like sensitive to it. And like, he was like, my mom was a big civil rights fighter. It's like, doesn't matter. You're not black, and you're not a black person standing in a plantation. Like yeah. your experience, your white guilt doesn't come close to it. So
I thought that was the okayest answer that a person could
yeah,
give under
agreed.
These
absolutely. It could have been so much worse.
Yeah.
Like what he said could have been so much more like condescending and like points to him for like really trying to be like, you know, I understand as much as I can as somebody who has not culturally been through this, mm-hmm. but it is causing some discomfort. But for whatever it's worth, and he's really the only one I follow on Twitter. Tom Colicchio has been like very, very much, you know, like I feel like he's been like very upfront about it. Like, yes, like, you know, this was awkward or whatever. I just feel like he hasn't been like, everybody's making too big a thing about it. I think he's been very like even-handed with like people's concerns about it. So
yeah, I mean, I guess if you set a season in Charleston, like it's going to be impossible for the history of the city to
right.
not come up. You know,
right?
So I feel like they probably had to have discussions about this in advance, where it's like, how are we actually going to portray this and address it, and you know, comment on it in a way that's going to be respectful without eliding the history of it. Where you know,
should we mention that every one of these places that's awkward is going to be hosting 12 weddings in the next week? No, don't do that, because you know that's the case.
That's very true, I'm sure.
You know, I mention this every time we talk about Top Chef, but one of the one thing that I thought was very interesting that I learned while we were at Bravo for Television of the Pity was how they choose the cities for Top Chef. And one of the biggest...
Yeah, that's what Jeff already said.
Yeah, one of the biggest things is that, they do it by sort of holes in their ratings, you know, matrix. But the other thing to keep in mind about Bravo, it is one of the whitest places that I've ever seen in my life. Like wall to wall white carpeting in that place. So that this might have been an afterthought wouldn't surprise me. Like, you know, that they built, you know, that they chose the location, that they set it all in motion, and then somebody was like, well, we do have to address this. And then you get this very awkward, moment and moments, you know, where they have this almost like white versus black, you know.
Well, and that aside, talking about like South Carolina's role as one of the original colonies and the importance of the place to, you know, in the American Revolution. And I'm like, and first one out the fucking door in 1860.
Right.
But that I guess we're not going to talk about that.
That was the funny thing to me is the white sort of the local white chefs talking about, like, you know, Charleston was actually very important in the American Revolution. And my immediate thought, too, was like, what about the subsequent conflicts in this country?
Yeah,
tell me some about
those.
Charleston was also very important in those, but maybe not in the way that you want to talk about right now.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, like, Tara, you like talked about how, like, I'm sure they had these conversations. I'm sure they did, too. But I'm also fairly sure it was a room full of white people talking about being sensitive.
Probably.
And, like, and in New York or whatever, talking about, like, yeah, we'll totally be sent. And then they get down to, like the South is a different place. You know, watch the TV show Atlanta if you want. Like, yeah. Like, it is like sitting in your office building in New York talking about how you're going to address the racial overtones of doing challenges literally at plantations, which is, no matter how much planning you're doing, like, that is a really bad choice.
Yeah.
You know.
Well,
oh, but
it's also a fun place to go of these houses, and it's like they're still referring to the Civil War as, quote, the War of Northern Aggression.
Sure.
And like, you know, you're just trying to be a tourist in Tennessee and you're at whatever, the Battle of Stones River site.
Right.
And it's like, this is, you think you understand it as someone from the North, but you don't. So,
yeah.
But I think it's making it really, as ill-advised as it is, I think it's pretty interesting to see, because they're going to continue struggling with this all season. And I sort of had fallen away from Top Chef in recent years because especially Padma was just getting on my last nerve. But the judging seems a little bit more like professional and less self-regarding so far in this season. Would you agree with that, Jeff?
I think so. I mean, it's always hard to tell. Like, they always have, like, it's Padma and Tom and Gail, and then, you know, in recent couple of seasons, it's been Richard Blaze, but it's like he's there like half the season at best. And this year, it's that Graham Elliott, I think, is
Master Chef.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Betrayal. That was kind of interesting. I like that guy.
He seems fine, but it's like already he's been there once out of two. So, like, to me, it's always the core three. And by that, I mean the core two and Padma. Because I take her criticisms. I like her there to be like a total bitch face to people. Like, you know, like she was with when the one team went to the lady's house, the lady who is famous for biscuits, who spent most of her time talking about her biscuits, and then they didn't make biscuits. And both she and Padma were like, where's the fucking biscuits? And it's like, you know, and it was like they literally, like, after going to the grocery store, and normally that part is so terrible and boring, but it was kind of hilarious because they were a mess. They, like, all went off in their own direction, so they came back, and so they had, like, 7 pounds of butter and 12 dozens of eggs. And it's like, okay, maybe you guys should have, like, confabbed about this beforehand, you know, and then after they got back, they were like, should we make biscuits? It's like, you shopped already. And like the guy they tried to throw under the bus to do it, the guy with immunity, he was like, we don't even have buttermilk. Like, freaking, like, no, I'm not going to make biscuits just because all of a sudden everybody's like, oh, maybe we should make biscuits. Like, go fuck yourself.
Yeah, you know?
And it was like, it was kind of awesome. I mean, that's not how he said it, because he's super proper, because he's the chef.
Executive chef at the Alabama State House. Is that it? Or something?
Yeah. And
the word biscuits
literally. Yeah. So, I mean, but I think what the show is doing well this season, I think, like, I don't really have an interest when it's like all like returning people, because it may as well be part non-returning people and part returning people anyway, because I never, like, half of them I don't remember anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and I've watched almost every season of Top Chef, but, like, you know, it is, I mean, it's empty calories for me, so.
Well,
like,
speaking of which, should we talk about the food? Have any of the dishes really impressed anyone thus far? I as I said in my intro, pickled raisins is the most insane thing I've ever heard of since raisins. Raisins should not be pickled. That's fucking
right.
Crazy.
Right. What about pickled craisins?
No.
I could not live or probably even visit Charleston because all the food looks totally gross to me. like I said up top, I'm vegetarian, so that's going to be really tough to start with. But yeah. Even, like, I don't know, just Southern cooking doesn't do it for me. Everybody's like, there's a chunk of the states that I've yet to visit, and it's that chunk, you know, kind of the triangle between, you know, Charleston and Louisiana and Florida, you know, like that, you know, that area. And I have to say, there's no cuisine that really is pulling me towards there, like it does, say, for instance, in the Southwest or something like that.
Well, I know my dear wife, Sarah, is a big fan of seafood. So what do you think, Sarah?
Well, it's tough because you go into that area. My in-laws are in, like, Chapel Hill and central North Carolina. And that whole triangle that Dave is talking about, I'm a vegetarian, so I'm a little more portable, this kind of cuisine. And also, my Native American name is Institutional Starch. So, like, butter beans boiled beyond recognition or taste is fine, as far as I'm concerned. It's like the state bird of Indiana is just like a sopping mess of something that used to be green. But there's nothing for you there, Dave Cole.
Oh, like, I know.
Literally, because they'll put bacon on anything. Mm-hmm. And then when you're like, well, but this is actually, you know, French toast. Could you take that up? This is oatmeal. This is a, you know, a salad. Can you take that off? And they're like, well, but then you won't have bacon on it. Like,
Yep.
It, like, a primavera doesn't have chicken. And then you have to very nicely explain that to these people. So they don't get Italian food either. So you eat a lot of terrible primavera with carrots, and it's
yeah, and cute. I also agree with the Tom Judge guy, Tom Colicchio.
Yep.
Is that how you pronounce it? Okra, weird.
Yeah.
How many times did that come up? What is his, like, did okra kill his parents? Why is he so anti-okra?
But because it's like such a weird, like, texture.
And yeah, it's just hairy on the outside and slimy on the inside.
Yeah.
It's like, you're like, how is this not an animal?
Well, no, like, how is it not an insect? That's the issue.
Yeah, even better. It's even better. Yeah.
Yeah,
I've never had it.
My only other thought about this really is I really love that one lady on the newbies team who's just really angry with everybody before she even meets everybody. I think she's just like, nah, I don't like these people.
Oh, the chinless one?
Well, the one that brought up buttermilk biscuits after the fact, her. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
She is my favorite because I feel like she's the only one keeping it real. Like, well, when you think about her, right? Because the culture of restaurants and chefs is very alpha, you know, very. Mm-hmm. And these chefs seem to be trying really hard to, like, be a chef family because they're in the group and we're all like, yeah. And they're all, like, friendly with each other. And, like, she seems like the one that would just be like, she is the same person on the show that she is in her restaurant. And I think that's the only person that I really make that connection to so far.
I think she did say some variation on "I'm not here to make friends."
She did,
I think
that was in the premiere. Yeah, she totally did.
And I know it's cliche, but that is why I enjoy people on reality shows, and why most of the people on reality shows I don't enjoy, because they are playing to the camera, you know. So
my favorite part about her, and it was echoed by then the guy who went home, and you knew he was going to go home because he was bragging about how well he cooked his pork. And of course he totally bungled it. is that both he and that woman, who I think her name is Emily.
Yeah.
Both of them were like, you know, like that BJ guy was like, I really, like, gravitate more towards the veterans. you know, and she's like, she like also chafed at being called a veteran. And it's like, right. But the rookie and veteran thing is those are Top Chef veterans.
Right.
And you are a Top Chef rookie.
Yeah.
It's not just veteran, period.
Right.
Like, so get over it. Like, mm-hmm. I don't care if you feel like you belong in the veteran group. You don't, because you've never been on this show. So, like, get over it.
Yeah.
But it's just, like, hilarious to me that people are like, you know, that they have that kind of issue. But of course they do, because they're chefs, and chefs are crazy, you know. You know, and just like, I think the best scene was like then when all the veterans are sitting around and they've all poured rosé, and then there's Casey, the blonde, who's poured like a 9-ounce glass of rosé. And it's like, oh, yeah. Don't hide it, Casey. Don't hide who you are. Don't hide your light under a bushel. And by light, I mean wine bottle. You know, like, it's so like, because that's the thing too, is like chefs are, I mean, you know, they're all like drug and alcohol addicts, so it's like I love that it's just out there for everybody to see. Like, I love any time that it's like the producers can't hide how much they're drinking, like when they're, you know, it's like,
or that they're smoking too.
Yeah,
like they try, but it's like, this is, they're chefs, the show is called Top Chef.
Yeah.
It's season whatever, a billion. Get like, don't run footage from when they're on the porch, because there's only one reason they go out there, and it's right. Not to look at butterflies.
No.
Get over it.
I know it's very early days yet, Jeff, but do you have any predictions for who you think might win this season?
I think a veteran's going to win. I think the rookies are right now. They've just shown themselves to be not smart time wise, and that's the killer. Like, yeah. You know, it's like, I mean, every time I make breakfast for, like, you know, I've got one biological kid and two foster kids, and like trying to, like, if I'm the one making the breakfast, like, I know how to, I've made pancakes a million times and there aren't that many ingredients, and I know where all of the ingredients are.
Yep.
And to make like pancakes and something else in like 20 minutes is next to impossible. So anytime I see them making something complicated, I'm like, I just don't even understand how you do it.
Yeah.
But like the new people so far just seem super, none of them have really risen to the top. I think that guy who's the executive chef of Alabama.
Yeah.
He's sort of surprising, because his first thing was like, what was it? Oh, it was chicken livers with strawberry sauce.
Yep.
And I was like, oh my God. It was so disgusting. But then the judges were like, that was really surprising. And it's like, okay.
You're forgetting. It was chicken liver, strawberries, and wasn't it like ranch dressing or something too? Like every part of it was disgusting.
Yeah, it was like first of all, one of the main thing, I do not like organ meat.
Yeah.
Like I can't get on board with it. And that's a big Southern thing also.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's like, I like ranch dressing, fine. I like strawberry sauce, fine. But I don't want those two things together. And then I don't want you to add liver to it. Right. Like, good Lord.
Well, and he had a whole chicken.
Yeah.
And they're like, this is what you give us.
Like,
but then it worked. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was the thing, is they had an hour. And some of them barely made one dish in an hour in that first episode. It's like, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
Because, like, I can make one dish in an hour.
Yes.
You know? And so, like, that's I don't know. I'm excited about the show, though, because I think the mixture of having returning people and newbies is, like, exciting. You know, because of the tension between them, but also because it's, like, you know, it's, like, people have things to prove for different reasons, you know, like the people who are coming back are like trying to prove that they didn't deserve to be sent home at whatever point they were sent home.
Yeah.
You know, and then the people who are new there are like those people who are saying, like, I really feel like I should be a veteran. It's like, well, you're not, because you're not a Top Chef veteran. But like the sentiment, I understand, like they want to be viewed as like as good as them. So then it's interesting to see who steps up. You know, it's like, I don't really like, I've shown a lot of hatred for Richard Blaze in my recaps, but like honestly, he shows up in all these other like cooking shows that my 6-year old loves to watch, and it's like he's whatever, like whatever. There are a lot worse people to watch on TV than Richard Blaze, but like this Graham Elliott guy seems cool. But like what I mainly like is I mainly like Tom and Gail, and I especially like Gail when she was so mad in the second episode. She was so mad about every one of the three dishes that like it's the more she talked, it was like she was ready to punch somebody. She was so angry about like that piece of pork was so poorly made. You know, it was just like she was just so upset. And I like that about her because I like that about the show that it's not just this arbitrary. They're not like Zach Posen on Project Runway where they're just like bitchy, like, you know. Oh, that's not pretty enough or whatever. Like, he's just – like, I feel like he's kind of arbitrary in some ways. But, like, with Tom and Gail especially, like, I feel like they're like – like, Tom is just like – if you mess up a protein, it's like you just walked over to him and, like, spit in his face. He's so – he's just like – it's so like – he's like – because he's, like, got that weird chef thing of, like, respect where the meat came from, respect this. Like, otherwise, why did we kill an animal for you to, like, just throw this piece of meat in the garbage? You know, it's like
– well, and also and if you cook pork incorrectly, then you're going to kill somebody.
Right.
So, like
– yeah. Oh, for sure.
Gail to be like, thanks for the trichinosis, dickwad. Like, yeah, I'm with that.
No, and so it's like, I like that after all of these seasons, those two still show a lot of passion for doing this show.
Yeah.
And that makes for, you know, and I think for whatever it's worth, and I've watched, like I said, like my 6-year old has been on this bender of looking at, of watching different cooking shows. He's fascinated by them, and like he's made us do like a version of Chopped, like where me and my wife,
I've seen the pictures on Instagram and it is adorable.
Me and my wife have to like come up with dishes to make, and then he like at first he was going to cook, and the first time he cooked one too, and he made this amazing like little just like sort of like vanilla cake type thing, like just it was just like, and he just kind of like whipped it together. Like, it was crazy. Anyway, it was just like, we're like, oh my God, this is delicious. But it's like, you know, like, it's, I don't know where I was going with all of that. So, look,
you're
I'm
tired.
On a lot
you
of cold
kids.
Medicine. I'm on a lot of cold medicine. You know, but I love the passion that they have for that, and that they have for the show, and, you know, and they care about it. And, you know, it's like, it is one of the better. It is still one of the better cooking shows out there, and it's probably the best, in my opinion. And you know, and so when they get the right variety of people in there, because that's what always makes the difference. You know, it's the same thing with Survivor or whatever. Like, if you don't get a good mix of people, then you know that's where you kind of have to. That's where the rubber meets the road. But I think they have a good mix, because there's people who are sleeper agents from the veterans who are definitely time bombs waiting to go off. They seem cool right now, but they're definitely gonna, like, the claws will come out. So I'm looking forward to that.
Well, we shall see, and we will follow your coverage on previously.tv.
Ah, I will too.
Good. Dear Mr. President. There are too many states nowadays. Please eliminate three. I am not a crackpot.
I am not a crackpot, but if you are producing one of those house hunting shows, you must only air episodes which feature an actual house purchase decision on the show.
Mm-hmm.
We were watching one of these shows called Hawaii Life. We only record the ones that take place on the same island we live on so that we can judge the house hunters harshly.
Yep.
For all their dumb choices. But we were watching last night. It's not the first time it happened, but it's just making me realize this needs to be spoken about on the podcast. There was a couple and they looked at three houses and they're like, nah, none of them are good. End of show.
Yeah. The end of it was literally like, well, we still live here and I hope we buy a house soon. Like, okay, so here we sit, what do we do? Why did we spend this half hour with you idiots?
Yeah, TV blue balls. Thanks a lot, guys. Like, the whole point of that show is, you know, to see the homes and to judge their choice.
Yeah.
And right. them as people and human beings, of course.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
So here's my solution. If you air an episode of one of these shows without a purchase being made, everyone involved in production must divide the cost of a representative house equally, buy it, and then they all have to use it as a very, very inconvenient timeshare.
Yeah, this is reasonable. This is reasonable.
I'm not a crackpot. Thank you very much. This is Extra Hot Great Micro.
We have a message from Katie.
Katie wanted us to give a shout out to her husband, Scott. And since she tells us that he was the one who introduced us to this very podcast, nothing would make us happier.
Whoops, that was bad copy on my part. Introduced her to this very podcast is what I meant. Lately, Katie and Scott have been watching Orphan Black together and both came to the realization that Katie herself has a TV clone and that, given that Katie is a short, spunky, clean freak soccer mom, that clone is Allison Hendricks.
So to honor Scott, someone Katie describes as a tall, dark, handsome, thrifty, OCD, handy, board and video game loving trivia maven with a dry sense of humor, Katie would like us to go around the horn and choose a TV persona for Scott. So here we go. Tara, start us off.
I say that based on the information we were given, Scott's TV clone is Ross Geller. He's tall. He's certainly dark.
Shit.
He's handsome. Was that your pick?
Yes.
I also
have a backup at school.
He has OCD tendencies. His thriftiness is inherent in his very deep attachment to his Thanksgiving turkey sandwich with moist maker. He certainly loves trivia. He crafted the game in the best episode of Friends ever. And all of them have a dry sense of humor when it's not wacky. So that is my pick. Sorry to pick yours, Sarah. Once again, we are mind melded here on the podcast.
Anything to add to Tara's argument?
No, not really. My backup was Ichabod Crane from Sleepy Hollow. Slightly less good of a match, but he is handy with a blunderbuss and does know a lot of trivia about revolutionary figures. Dave.
Mine is, and it matches everything kind of to a scary degree, except for the tall part and dark. But he's handsome. He's thrifty. He definitely has OCD. He's a tinkerer. He is a game fan and trivia maven, and he has a dry sense of humor. That's Ben Wyatt from Parks and Recreation.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Played by Strong. Adam Scott.
Oh shit.
Oh.
And Jeff, do you have a match for us?
I do. It's maybe not the best match, but I feel like there are aspects of him that remind me of Putty from Seinfeld.
Oh yeah.
And, sure. Just because I think I was zeroing in on, you can't tell if he's joking,
yep.
even though he's always joking.
Yep.
And also, I feel like I can imply that Putty is OCD and Putty has some of these qualities, mm-hmm. but you never know because Putty is a closed book. So.
Well, he's definitely handy. He's a car mechanic, so he's got yep. that down for sure. So yeah, we did it.
And he's tall and handsome.
He is both those things for sure. From all of us here at Extra Hot Great and from Katie, thanks for being a fan, Scott.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Scott. Now it is time to go around the dial. The first stop, Tara Ariano.
As we record this, last night was the season finale of HBO's Divorce. A show I really wanted to like more than I did because I like Catastrophe so much, which comes from one of the two writers of Catastrophe, Sharon Horgan. I had very high hopes, and I think in the first few episodes, I was really like, willing it to be a better show than it was, and it has interesting elements, and Thomas Hayden Church is so funny in the role of the husband that she's divorcing. He's just really goes for it in a very unflattering and unlikable role with a very stupid mustache. He just, like, the first scene that we're introduced to him, he comes in to hassle her for taking so long in the bathroom because he had to take a shit in a coffee can, and he has the coffee can in his hands to show her. So that's him in a nutshell. But it sort of ends on a cliffhanger of like the yaw of the season has been back and forth between whether their divorce is going to be acrimonious or not, and it ends on a, you know, down note in terms of that. But I feel like I would like it better if the lead female were not Sarah Jessica Parker, because she's so grating. Oh God, there's a scene in the finale where she's she's just opened this art gallery in town, and so she's giving like a little speech, and I swear to God, she like smooths her hair back from her face like 15 times in this 5-minute speech. It's just so, she's so irritating. I don't know. I mean, I never really watched Sex and the City that much, so I didn't think I had that much baggage with her. Maybe I do, because she just really is annoying in this part. She's like one of the worst things about the show. Every scene with any of her friends who are played by like Talia Balsam, Molly Shannon and Tracy Letts are another couple friend of theirs, and both of them are so funny, especially Tracy Letts. He's great. He gets shot in the premiere, so that's sort of his storyline from, or no, he has a heart attack. He doesn't get shot. He almost gets shot. Oh, anyway.
I love that guy.
He's great. I just rewatched his that episode of Seinfeld that he was in, because he's in the Festivus episode, and even when he was young, real foxy with a stupid haircut in that episode from 1997. Anyway, I digress. Divorce is okay. I guess I will keep watching it when it comes back for season two, but yeah, I would more recommend that instead of watching the 10 episodes of Divorce that have aired in season one, you watch the 12 episodes of Catastrophe that are on Amazon. I know our guest Jeff Drakes would agree with me on that.
Absolutely.
And for my plug, I just want to mention again with this, our 90210 podcast goes back to 2 episodes a week as of right now. So if you're not subscribed, there's a shitload of them. Please go back and start listening from the beginning, 800 episodes ago.
Yes, back when shows apparently could do 32 episodes a year.
Yeah, I started doing the notes for the episodes that we're recording this week, and I was like, oh, season episode 22, we must be almost done. Oh no, I forgot there's 10 more episodes this season. What the hell? Anyway, that's my plug.
Jeff Drake.
Me. It's my turn. I will talk about the TV show Fleabag, which I believe is on Amazon.
Correct.
Is that where I watched it?
You did.
If you haven't seen it or don't know anything about it, the title Fleabag won't really help you at all. There's no explanation for why it's called that exactly, but it's about this woman who's kind of a disaster, who is single and dating, and I mean, that's really about all it. It's British, and it's just about one of the best things I've ever seen on television. Her character is so outrageously endearing and also like cringeworthy, because it's really, it does all of those things that I think a great comedy, like I think it goes really well hand in hand with like Catastrophe, where there's like amazing amazing moments of comedy, and then the season finale is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And I like, it's also something, I think there's just 6 episodes.
That's correct.
Yeah. And it's so terrific. It's like totally 3 hours of your time that you will cherish. And then we tried to watch, and I can't remember what it's called now. She did another one before Fleabag. And we tried to watch it, and it was unwatchable.
Okay.
But I'll have to come back. I'll figure it out, and I'll come back on that. But please seek out Fleabag. You will not regret it. It is one of the funniest, best shows.
Yeah.
It also has a guy with the most hilarious teeth.
Yes.
And
those aren't his real teeth, thank God. But yes, they are hilarious. Yeah,
they totally look like they could be his real teeth, even though they are comically rodent-like.
Yep.
And – oh my God! Oh, it is really, it's just amazing. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, we watched it a couple of weeks ago. I'd seen people raving about it, and I was like, I don't know if this is going to be Dave's thing. Let's give it a shot. And it had one of the, I can't say what it makes it so good without spoiling it, but one of the best cold opens of a series premiere ever. Yeah. Oh my God, the punchline it ends.
That's
so
what I was going to say.
It's so great.
You'll be able to tell if you're going to like the show or not.
Yes.
The investment is about 4 minutes to the point of the cold open. You're either going to like it or you're not. And then based on reaction to that, you can continue watching the show or not. Like, it's a nice little litmus test. at the beginning of that show for sure. It is really fucking funny.
Yeah, it's good. Really absolutely. Good.
Yeah. Anything to plug there, Mr. Drake?
It's all just cold medicine and sleep over there.
Sarah T. Bunting.
Speaking of sleep, Pitch, Fox's first lady in baseball drama, ended its first season last week as we record this. And I was hoping, Tara, that you could share your grand unifying theory of Pitch's possible renewal.
That ended up being totally wrong? Sure.
No. I mean, I still think if it were true, if it had happened, you would have been right. But anyway.
Well, yeah, my theory when we were last week, we were discussing this, and I said I thought what would happen was that when the Golden Globe nominations came out, which is today, that at least Kylie Bunbury, who plays the lead, Ginny, would get nominated for Best Actress, and that the show possibly might get nominated. Because the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, they're so perverse. Like, their last, I think their reigning comedy show is Mozart in the Jungle, the show no one you know has ever watched or knows exists. Their shit is so, their nominees and are so weird. Their winners are often very weird also. I mean, they also nominated The Martian as one of its best comedies last year. Like, they don't know what the fuck is going on. And so the thing about the Golden Globes, though, is that they love an ingenue, and they love to be the ones that, like, anoint a young up-and-coming female star. We saw this with Jennifer Garner on Alias and Keri Russell on Felicity. And more recently, the last two winners of Best Actress in a Comedy were Rachel Bloom last year and Gina Rodriguez the year before from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend and Jane the Virgin. So I was like, Kylie Bunbury totally slots into that slot, basically, that they always have at the Golden Globes. That could be her. And then what's going to happen is, because Pitch has been like, hasn't been renewed yet, that's going to be the thing where Fox is like, well, people seem to like it, so I guess we'll renew it. Cut to Golden Globe nominations. Nothing for Pitch. I was 100% wrong. Continue, Sarah.
I do think that's a good theory, though. And she wasn't bad.
She was fine.
But unfortunately, it's just one of those like roles where she has to be a lot of things.
Yeah.
She's not really anything. Mm-hmm. She's just kind of this, like, character wise, she's not all that interesting.
Yeah.
She's just plot. I don't think they should renew it. I am not who this show is for, obviously, because the show didn't want to really be about baseball, which annoyed me like every single minute that I was watching it. But, the problem is, like, they already ran through so many, like, stereotypically baseball drama plots that I don't know what the show would be about. Like, it ended, if you're not caught up yet, turn away. It ended on her suffering an injury and she's going into the MRI, and that's the last shot of the episode. And it's like, but they can't really make that a story either. Because if the show's about her playing and she's not playing, then there's no show. I mean, there is with the, whatever, her hooking up with the Lawson character. And Mark Paul Gosselaar has been so great on this show and has really bailed out several of the episodes. But I just, even if it were like for me and I did enjoy watching it, I just don't see where it even goes from here. So I hope they declare this noble experiment a semi-success and then remake it or do it about another team. Or
yeah, what if they decided to make it like an anthology show and then it was a totally different baseball topic next time?
I'd be into that.
Right.
Yeah,
well, they should. So, I don't know, I have no control over that, obviously.
Well, yeah, I mean, if their basis for continuing was, well, maybe it'll get some awards attention, and yeah, it got nothing, then yeah, just take it out behind the TV barn and shoot it. My plug is for Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs, my podcast that I do with Mark Blankenship, occupier of the Mark Blankenship chair and frequent guest on Extra Hot Great. Last week, we dropped a definitive ranking of the entire Immaculate Collection album by Madonna, with scandalous results. We have a Christmas songs episode coming up, but really, my plug is for our producer and co-host on this podcast, David T. Cole, because until you've tried to drop like 17 Madonna clips in with like weird feedback that your sound test didn't tell you was happening and trying to sync things up, what Dave does is hard. Let us all appreciate Dave.
Dave.
Dick.
I am submitting Funhouse, the season 2 finale of The Sopranos. The show did many things well, and one of them is the way it portrays the unconscious. From the very first episode where Tony's unconscious conflict produces his signal symptom, panic attack, to his interactions with TV's least ever cringe-inducing therapist, Dr. Melfi, to the use of dreams to reveal characters' motivations and feelings, this episode captures best the sense of dreams' power to distill truths that we spend waking life not seeing. Tony has spent most of season 2 occupied and distracted with the comic foils Richie Aprile and Janice Soprano. All the while, his best friend, Big Pussy Bumpensero, has been an FBI informant. The season shows us, the audience, Pussy's spiral of guilt, entitlement, self-righteousness, and mortal terror. But only small waves of these emotions reach Tony, leaving him vaguely and mostly unconsciously suspicious. In the course of season 2, Tony acts in ways that suggest he knows Pussy is no longer one of them, but he refuses to really see until his dreams in Funhouse show him. The episode opens with Tony sending his mother out of town with stolen tickets, ill-gotten gains from earlier in the season. As we see next, a new scam is underway targeting immigrants looking for cheap ways to call home. Tony and Pussy are toasting a new business partner at an Indian restaurant. As Rolling Stones' Through and Through begins to play, Tony celebrates at Vesuvio with his people. Never too to turn down food, Tony and Pussy eat again, while Pussy explains the scam in excruciating, "I'm being taped for the feds" detail to Furio. Tony gazes at Pussy, knowing without knowing. After returning home with a gift for Carmela and being thanked enthusiastically for it, it seems as though Tony's night couldn't be better. But he is about to have a massively awful food poisoning intercut with creepy as hell dreams. While not related to my overall argument, the food poisoning storyline yields creative Indian-directed racism, as well as the funniest line of the episode from Meadow.
Jesus. Oh, fuck! Oh, fuck! It's a chicken vindaloo! Fucking motherfucking lugs!
Mom, what's going on?
Your father is sick.
Oh my god, Daddy, what happened?
I went to an Indian restaurant.
That is so racist.
He's letting those big ones.
The episode hereafter slips into and out of Tony's dreams, and even when he's really awake, the dreamlike quality persists. I could go on and on about these dreams, but instead I'll make a few key points. One, dreams disguise. And the closer you are to waking, the less disguised the dream. In two of the early dreams, Tony's antagonist seems to be Polly. Polly is the one who hands him the lighter to set himself on fire. And Tony returns the favor in a different dream by shooting him in the chest. Tony knows he has an enemy, but he's not ready to see who it is. Two, dreams offer a, well, funhouse reflection of the problems we're working on in waking life. Reminders of Pussy build steadily during the course of this episode, bringing Tony closer. In the first dream on the boardwalk, Pussy is there, but not there, seen only in profile and disengaged, before disappearing altogether.
Where's Pussy? Our true enemy has yet to reveal himself.
Where is he?
Who?
Pussy.
Did you call Pussy? He had the muscles too.
Jesus, Artie, call Pussy. Some concern, maybe?
I am. I feel very bad for him.
Oh, Pussy.
So, who's your friend? Pussy?
I'm confused.
Isn't Pussy your friend?
Yeah.
But that's the friend that was almost carried off by the ducks, right?
What the worst part of this is? This is one of those situations where I know I'm dreaming.
Well, let's look at it.
When you say Pussy, you mean my friend Pussy or, you know, Pussy?
Whatever seems to be dominating your thoughts.
I got Pussy on the brain. I always do.
Finally, we get the dream that wraps up Tony's uneasy suspicion. The dream where Pussy, as a fish, forces through Tony's denial.
You know I've been working with the government, right, Tone?
Don't say it.
Come on, Tone. Sooner or later, you gotta face facts.
I don't want to hear it.
Well, you're gonna hear it. You passed me over for promotion, Tone. You knew.
How much shit you give him?
A lot.
Jesus, Push. Fuck him, I'll wait for it all to end, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
These guys, on either side of me, they're asleep.
Don't say that. It's not fucking funny. I will see you flopping around down there.
Tony wakes up writhing on his bathroom floor, the rest of the day given over to murder. He and the guys show up at Pussy's, and hearing his wife open the door to them, Pussy bolts up in bed in panic, as if he has been having parallel dreams all night. He doesn't have time to put his recording gear on, and when Tony fakes another bout of illness to be left alone, Tony finds the wire. As if to underscore the pit in the stomach dread of finding this evidence, we get one more dream where everything is opposite. Incidentally, another dream trope. His opposite family, wife and kids, share their opposite news, all good and happiness. Tony jerks awake in the back of the car that's taking Pussy to his death. The scenes on the boat where the murder takes place are heartbreaking to me, but I appreciate that the episode doesn't stop there. In most TV shows, the episode probably would have ended with this traumatic murder. But Funhouse goes on and on, purposefully it seems, as Tony's business can't stop with this any more than any other murder or betrayal. Time slowed long enough for him to learn what he needed to, but meandering dream time is over now. Tony is arrested for the stolen tickets. He has a conference with his lawyer. He has a therapy session, in which Melfi correctly identifies his sadness in the form of anger and delivers a factually correct interpretation that he is unable to accept. And finally, he sees Meadow graduate high school and then hosts a party for her. In the final montage to the same Rolling Stones song that opened the episode, the crew's misdeeds from season two, both life-ruining and petty, flash across the screen, ending on a shot of the Atlantic, where Pussy is at rest. I was always a sucker for Pussy's storyline, but his ending in particular, seen mostly through Tony's unconscious, is canon-worthy. While it is arguably more fun to watch Tony reluctantly keep alive people he hates, but isn't allowed or cravenly doesn't want to kill, there is real heartbreak in watching him reluctantly kill someone he loves. And in spite of the fact that he never hesitates, the murder does not go down easily. Pussy reappears in subsequent seasons, not least in the form of the trendy Big Mouse Billy Bass that one of the guys brings into the Bing. And Tony's violent reaction to the echo of this dream underscores how powerfully dream symbols can linger. So I hope you will do this psychoanalytic therapist a solid and send Funhouse into the canon, not only for being a stellar season finale by any measure, but for being a serious attempt to represent the unconscious on television.
Wow, excellent presentation. That was Hallie. Thank you, Hallie. As the basically chairman of Sopranos canon submissions around here, I will go first. First, I'd like to say there's something about that closing montage. Like, sometimes montages can be cheap, but there's something about this one, like, that sort of push-in shot on Tony lighting a cigar and, like, not looming, but, like, presiding over his, like, fiefdom, and his daughter's just graduated and all his lieutenants are there. And, like, I just really miss Gandolfini. I kind of miss this show. I wish that, you know, we were going to get that movie that they were talking about, which, of course, we can't, because Gandolfini has died. Here's the thing, though. I would never have proposed this episode for the canon because this is not a popular opinion, and you can argue with me, that's fine. I think season two overall is overrated. It's not bad, it's overrated. I think Chase's dream sequences got increasingly self-indulgent. Occasionally they were effective, but now having seen all of them, that sort of reflects back on the earlier ones. This is, you know, it's done okay, but it's dreams. It's like dreams of people you know. Like, do you want to know what I dreamed last night? No. Not really. Yeah, I don't I don't know. Like, I enjoyed watching this episode. And one of the things about a canon submission is that, like, one of the criteria that we sometimes use is, like, did it make you want to keep watching? And it did make me want to keep watching. And I just, like, flipped over into season three and watched a few of those because it's my favorite season. But is Funhouse that much better than the, you know, than other Sopranos episodes? Is it that much more significant than other Sopranos episodes? You could argue that it is. It is full of classic lines. It is a, you know, legendary character death. But I'm not sure that it is canon for this show. That is my opinion. Jeff Drake.
Thank you. I think that's well argued. And I think the way this canon submission was put forward was great. Especially at the end, guilting us into, like, oh, okay, so you're a therapist who knows what you're talking about as far as dream symbology
yes.
goes. Okay, so if we didn't get it, then we're dumb. No, I'm kidding.
That was a very elegant manipulation, Dr. Halley.
It was very, well, that was very nice manipulation, and I do appreciate it. I was never in the bag for The Sopranos. And so it was interesting for me to watch because, like, I don't know how this turns out. But what I also didn't know that I then, when I read up on the episode after seeing it, was like how, like, it just wasn't imbued in me how close of friends that Tony and Big Pussy are. And if you don't know that going into the episode, you're not he's just another foot soldier to you. And so the emotional impact of this episode is lessened considerably if it's just another foot soldier. You know, if you don't know that there was a deeper connection between Tony and Big Pussy, then his trouble coming to grips with that doesn't really have as much weight. I was never in the episodes that I watched, like, I don't know, the dream. I'm kind of with Sarah on the dream thing. Like, it's not, you know, some of it is like the stuff that's closer to being dreamlike is more entertaining to me, even though there's less information there because, like, dreams are so frequently just like, why did Tony just set himself on fire? Like, you know, like, as opposed to, like, the very literal sleep with the fishes moment, you know, which is, like, right. So on the nose that to me it's like, is it really that great? You know, it's like, and I know the show, like, the one thing that this episode reminded me is just how great an actor James Gandolfini is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, his, and it's just in the subtle, in the subtlety of his eyes. Like, that they could go from, like, looking, like, oh, I can see how he's charming, to, like, oh, it's like that speech in Jaws where Robert Shaw talks about the black doll's eyes, like, with no life in them. And I worked for somebody like that, who, like, was, like, so charming, and then you could see the life go out of his eyes, and it was, like, time to leave the room. Like, this guy is crazy. And so, like, that part was really great. There's a lot of good stuff about it, but I feel like if it's a canon submission, it does make me, it, as somebody who was not a huge Sopranos fan, I feel like a canon submission of The Sopranos should make me want to, like, reconsider that stance. Instead, it's sort of like I enjoyed the episode a lot, although not much more the second half of it than the first half. Like, when it was just really kind of dreamy and stuff, just, you know, I just didn't have a lot to hang stuff on because, you know, it just didn't, it was all sort of dependent upon all this stuff that had happened previously. So that end montage goes right by me also because I don't know what they're shots of, you know, and until I read about it. And so while I think it's a well-argued canon submission and I think it's a well-done episode and there's a lot to recommend the episode, to me it feels a little too inside baseball to be a canon submission.
I'll start with a very stupid note because no one else brought it up. The Foley work on the sick farts. Guys.
It's really hard to go against that, especially that last little one that just
well, it's so also bad. The desperation. It's also like the finish line farts of him running to the toilet and getting there just in time, and then all hell breaks loose.
Well, then he's barfing, and then like the barf happens, and then there's like as the afterthought, it's like the thunder after the lightning of the farts. Like,
but it's also his like. His being at the end of his rope, you know, when he's just like, he just screams, oh, it was the chicken vindaloo. like, and then punctuating that with a nice beefy fart.
Yeah.
Is like, yeah, I mean, it's juvenile and it's silly, but fuck me if it doesn't work.
But it's not just that, it's not just the funniness of the farts. It's like the accuracy of the sound. Like someone was recording some real legit farts that they had the last time they were sick. I just love to imagine the sound designer being like, oh, I feel so bad, but I gotta get this down.
I have my craft.
Exactly.
My craft.
Look, we all had a dad. We know what a dad fart sounds like. It sounds like that. Sorry, Dad. Yep. Hi, Dad. I would say the other things that I thought were kind of fun about this episode was like the parts that haven't aged, like the whole thing with the calling cards, like not even a thing anymore. I remember when I used to have those, like from before I had a cell phone. But I actually, as someone who normally hates dream sequences, I thought the ones in this episode were really well done because of, I mean, the shortness of them contributes to how effective they are, I think. And that, as she says, like the dreams that you have when you're the closest to waking are the most evocative. And I mean, the fish one is bad. I agree. That's too on the nose and too corny. But the rest of them, they have the quality of like, it's the same principle behind, you know, when you have epiphanies in the shower of like when you stop thinking about something directly, then it sort of slides in to your subconscious and then the truth is revealed. And that's what happens with Tony and, you know, what's been going on with Big Pussy's storyline this whole season. I don't know. I was leaning toward voting for it. And then Sarah, as the chairman of The Sopranos, kind of talked me out of it. And it reminded me, too, that my favorite episode of this season was the one that sort of alluded to sideways in the episode also, which is Bust Out, where the very processy one that the Robert Patrick guy who comes back for the graduation in this episode where they, you know, ruin his business basically because he's a degenerate gambler, which was like, I just love that one for how specific it gets about like, these are the mechanics of how you get yours back if you're a mobster. So that would have been my pick for this season. But anyway, I'll hold my comments to the end. Dave.
Okay. I thought that the dream parts got pretty cartoony at times, and into, you know, as a siloed event, I did enjoy them. Like, you know, as we say, the juicy dad farts and everything were amusing entertainment into themselves. I am also not a fan of the dream sequence as a general rule. That this one vacillates between sort of that lucid three steps removed associations that you have, you know, when you have those dreams, you're like, what the fuck was that? And then you think, okay, this is where my brain went. It went from A to B to Q. That is entertaining to see once. This is an episode I don't think that is very rewatchable for that reason. I find like, you know, the tone, and not only is Foley work on the GI track, but also the Foley work of like the dream soundtrack almost with the creaking wood and these weird almost underwater boink boink like weird noises like somebody's tapping.
Yeah, like they're already on the boat from the end.
Yeah.
And there is that one bit when he's looking through the like binocular things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he can't quite see. Like, occasionally, Chase will have this image that's, like, really, like, in later seasons, there's one with, like, a Livia figure at the top of the stairs that will really make your hair stand up, but he doesn't always know when to stop, so.
Yeah, I feel like less would have been more on the dream stuff.
That applies to the whole series, though, also.
Yes, that is true. But for me, here's where I'm placing this. Like, I don't think this is a bad episode, even though I wouldn't vote for it for canon. But for me, this episode is on par with another dream episode from another show. Who recognizes this?
Delicious.
What kind of cake are you eating?
It is a cellular peptide cake. Meant frosting. Would you like a bite?
No, thank you.
That is from Phantasm, the Next Generation episode that you may remember where Troy is a cake and people are eating Troy.
Oh, yeah.
It's Data's having dreams and all this weird shit happens and it's all very... you know, crazy and symbolic and everything. I feel like this is just another one of those, to be honest with you. I mean, Sopranos dresses it up better. And I think people remember it because a character called Big Pussy dies at the end of it. I wonder what the trajectory would be of episodes if that character was named something else. If his name was just John. Oh, John died in this episode. Yeah, I remember that episode with the dreams. That was weird. And John died at the end, but it's Big Pussy. Yay. So I think there's a Big Pussy bump is what I'm saying.
But, should have that looked at.
Yeah, not a fan of the dream stuff. I think it can be amusing in the moment, but I don't think those episodes tend to last. So with that, I will start the voting and say a no for me. So let's start back at the top. Sarah?
This was a very fine submission. This is a very fine episode, but for me, with this particular show, which is probably my favorite show of all time, the bar has to be a little higher. Totally get it, but that's a no for me as well. Not quite there.
Mr. Drake?
Yeah, sadly, it's a no for me as well.
And Tara?
It's a no for me, but if someone wants to submit Bust Out, I'm all about it. I guess I already took
my hand.
Me
too.
All right, so that means... The Sopranos, Season 2, Episode 13, Funhouse. I'm sorry to inform you, you are not inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yeah.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for Winner and a Loser of the Week. The winner this week comes from Tara Ariana.
It's Jimmy Kimmel, and I will explain why in just a second. We forgot to say, please submit your canon arguments to us. We love to hear them, and we love to...
And your Nonax as
and
well.
Nonax
as
well,
love that
of
music.
Course.
And if you need any Sopranos Nonax suggestions, I got a bunch. Email me, sarah@previously.tv.
Winner of the Week is Jimmy Kimmel because he's hosting the Oscars in 2017. Big whoop. They're back on ABC where they also had the Emmys this year, so he hosted those too. Like, this is not an interesting choice. Our friend and former colleague Joe Reed has been pitching Melissa McCarthy and Sandra Bullock as co-hosts for the Oscars since The Heat, and I think that would be a much better one. Other suggestions that I read on Twitter this week, The Rock. Who wouldn't want to see The Rock host the Oscars over Jimmy
Why
Kimmel?
Hasn't that happened? Doesn't it seem like that should have happened like 5 years ago already?
He's hilarious. He's attractive. He's funny. He's good looking. He's tall. He's built.
He's hot.
He can sing. He's easy on the eyes. Have I mentioned he's attractive? Anyway, suck a dick, Jimmy Kimmel, but congratulations, I guess.
Okay, loser of the week.
Oh, wow.
Well.
Speaking of sucking of metaphorical dicks, our loser is NBC's Dignity. Again, some more. Donald Trump is retaining a credit and income from The Celebrity Apprentice. Someone needs to just fucking cancel that abortion and throw it in the sea. Get it done.
Yep.
But there's no reason that you can't change your vishy ways regarding our president-elect. Just put your fucking foot down already. But I guess it's not happening. Sigh.
Speaking of sigh, do you know what time it is?
Game time.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new season of Game Time. The world is new and full of possibilities.
Someone has a steel meal, right? Doesn't the valued guest have two? Two steel meals?
That is correct.
All right.
Keep that in mind, Jeff Drake.
Jeff Drake.
Oh, yep. Boy.
You got two of those opportunities if you want to burn them both for all of the valued guests this season. That's your right.
Oh, okay. That's for everybody. Okay.
But you can.
Okay.
Today we are playing popular hits from John Horner, who earns himself an extra credit. Redeemable for an extra hot great mini topic of his choosing. There are 9 rounds in popular hits.
Oh boy.
Each round is based on a popular song, which is also used as an episode title across multiple shows.
Oh boy.
Jeez. Changes come through.
I will read a redacted log line for the episode. You tell me the show for 1 point. Picky.
We will start with Sarah.
Sarah, Jeff, Tara is our order. Are we ready to play popular hints?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Sarah, round 1, changes.
Ah, I knew it.
Jesus.
The episode title is Chicha Chicha Changes. The episode synopsis is, with TMU trying to recruit blank, blank insists that she will not be moved away from blank. The quad rugby recruiters in Austin deliver some bad news to blank. What's the show?
That is Friday Night Lights.
Friday Night Lights.
For 1 point?
Wow. 1 point.
Okay.
Jeff Drake. Changes. 3 ches, not 4.
Oh.
Tia and Tamara come up with an excellent plan to get Ray and Lisa together for a romantic evening. Everything is going as planned until Lisa's friend Patrice visits and everything comes to a screeching halt. What's that show?
I don't know. We broke Jeff.
It's called Sister Bomb.
Wow, you were really close.
So close.
Yeah, that was it right.
Okay.
Sister.
I knew it was sister something.
We are at a steady decay rate. This is changes.
Okay.
Two ches.
Got it.
Blank is hired to determine the competency of a convicted murderer who has been granted a new trial. After examining the killer, who has subsequently suffered a brain injury and now exhibits a completely changed personality, Blank asserts that he's essentially no longer the same person and should no longer be held accountable for the murder. Good luck with this one.
Hannibal?
Perception.
Oh.
Perception.
Wow. Oh, yeah, that one. That yeah. show.
Back to Sarah. Your second and last question in round 1 changes. Blank seems, though this is Chicha changes again.
Okay.
Blank seems to be going through some changes. Developing alien powers wasn't something she expected, but it's definitely happening. Meanwhile, Blank gets a chance at a record deal and is completely oblivious to what her best friend is going through.
Best friend, probably.
What'd I say? Breast friend?
Breast friend.
Breast fiend. Roswell?
Nice.
What?
Wow.
That was the breast answer.
Yeah.
I always get the Roswell question, and I always get it right. It's sort of fucked up.
Jeff Drake, funny. Once again, changes. Oh, a body of a woman, her throat slit, is found in her car next to the highway. Autopsy reveals that Wendy was once a man who underwent a sex change operation. To solve this case, Blank and his team ventures into the world of transsexual people where no one is as they seem.
I'm going to guess this is from yesteryear.
Well. Yep. It's not from super yesteryear.
No, but...
But it's, you know,
it's from
pre-Obama, you know.
Yes. A less enlightened time.
Boy. That means that my guess is probably wrong. CSI?
Yep.
Yeah, correct.
Nice.
They love non-typical sexual murder victims on CSI.
Wow. Ellipsis changes.
Got it.
Blank is preparing his film class's final exam by videotaping all individuals involved, as well as helping Blank's father extend the ice house. Don't get this one, you're fired.
Yeah, seriously.
Dawson's Creek? Okay.
You are correct. That's round 1.
Not trying to get fired. Jeff and I are tied with 1 each. Sarah is in the lead with 2.
All right. Round 2, Won't Get Fooled Again.
Yeah.
The title is Won't Get Fooled Again. Sarah Bunting. Blank shooting a bunny turned police cadet. What? Blank shooting a bunny. Blank shooting a bunny turned police cadet. Oh, I see.
blank, shooting a bunny, comma, turned police cadet Susie off completely after blank gets worked up because blank said she had to give up her career. Her pregnancy turns out to be a false alarm.
What?
Blank shooting a bunny makes police cadet Susie not feel great about things. Blank gets worked up because blank said she had to give up her career. Her pregnancy turns out to be a false alarm. Whew. Power of commas, people.
The bunny is just...
Well, the way I read it, shooting a bunny turned police cadet. It's like, wow. It's like Zooropa or something.
Zootopia?
Oh, yeah. Zootopia.
Yeah.
Zooropa.
So close.
What is that?
So close.
You too.
You too, Al.
Yeah. Nobody understands my mysterious ways.
No, and I don't know this, so I'm just going to guess Cagney and Lacey.
No. Sorry for that. That was terrible. That was 70s show.
Oh, that's Jesus. That thing. Yes.
All right.
Won't get fooled again, Jeff Drake. The blank team is called to Florida, where a series of efficient bombs killed every single target. This rules out a terrorist or politically motivated bomber. What's the show? Won't get fooled again.
Where are they called?
Florida is called to Florida. The blank team is called to Florida. Then bomb stuff.
Criminal Minds.
That's what I would have guessed.
Nice. That's correct.
Nice too.
Well,
that
guessed.
Was going to be my guess for the previous one.
All right, Tara. Won't get fooled again. Mm-hmm. Blank overhears plans for a party and enlists blank to help her dress up to her social status. Blank finds out she and Patrick like the same band, and he invites her to a concert. Both Stratford sisters sneak out of the house, but neither of their nights turned out as planned.
10 Things I Hate About You.
Correct. Back to Sarah. Won't get fooled again. Blank has returned to Earth. Sarah, please.
Yes.
Well, therefore,
space.
Thank you. Blank has returned to Earth. People from his past and present appear. Is this some trick? If so, who's behind it and why?
That could be so many different spacey things. So I'm just going to guess Star Trek original series.
Farscape.
Oh.
Yeah,
but whoa. Okay.
All right. Won't get fooled again. Ellipses question mark.
Oh.
Sean Farquhar returns to try and fool them again, doing a memory trick. Michael Kent does a trick with bottles and glass cups. Nathan Burton does a couple of disappearing people tricks. Nathan Marsh does a trick with a small glass jar. And finally, blank and blank do an audience participation trick with cards.
Penn and Teller get killed?
No.
Oh.
Close. Penn and Teller fool us.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that was a show, but...
All right, last question of round two. Tara Ariana won't get fueled again.
Oh.
Blank's beach party turns too hot when the gate is crashed by student Dan Granger, who is literally on fire. The new pathologist, Dr. Tara Price, who impresses Blank in more than one way, finds he also has bad eternal burns. Internal burns. Not eternal. I mean, it might be. I don't know. But the show's got to end sometime.
Oh, God. CSI Miami?
Correct.
Wow. Nice.
That's round two.
Still very close. Now Jeff and Sarah are tied with two each. I have three.
All right. Back to the game. Round three. Heaven Can Wait. Heaven Can Wait. Sarah D. Bunting. Blank's latest nightmare is to turn literally into her ma, who would thus cease to appear in her dreams. Her athletic friend Blank turns up, but has a tumor. Operating on it could cost him the arm he would give his life for.
Whoa.
A lot of stuff happening in this one episode of...
Can I have that first sentence again?
Yeah, the first sentence is pretty important for what I remember from the show. Blank's latest nightmare is to turn literally into her mother, who would thus cease to appear in her dreams.
Medium?
Providence. Tough one. Deep cut.
Huh.
With the guy from MASH and the lady with the hair.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Heaven can wait, Jeff Drake. Blank plans blank and blank's wedding while trying to keep her distance from the over flirtatious Dr. Blank.
Seems like some of those should be not blanks.
All right. I'm going to give you one of them. Let's see. You know what, Jeff? Which one do you want? Blank one, two, three, or four?
Three.
Blank plans blank and Susan's wedding while trying to keep her distance from the over flirtatious Dr. Blank.
Oh, Grey's Anatomy.
Very close. Mm. Private Practice.
Oh, dang it.
I would guess DR. Sure.
Tari Ariano.
Yes.
After being stabbed in the heart, Blank has a profound experience in the liminal space while a desperate Blank and Blank race against the clock to save her life. Meanwhile, Blank is pulled into the ER to treat a suicidal patient that tests his duty as a doctor.
Oh, well, I had a guess, and that's definitely not that based on the second sentence.
Would you like a blank? I feel like that's four blanks. You should get a blank, too.
Sure. Give me the last blank.
Meanwhile, Joel is pulled into the ER to treat a suicidal patient.
Joel.
Yeah.
Well, this is not right, but all I got is Northern Exposure.
I can see why you guessed that. This is Saving Hope. Saving Hope. Heaven Can Wait, Sarah D. Bunting. Blank and Blank team up to find a Rit Zine, Z-I-E-N, an angel healer who is easing people's suffering by killing them.
Zine? There's a zine about angels? I'm so confused.
Zine, Z-I-E-N.
Like it's a name of something.
Okay. Rit Zine, yeah. That is the name of an angel healer.
Okay. Lucifer.
Blank and Blank was a good clue there. That's Supernatural.
Oh, of course. Good old Blank and Blank.
Yep. Good old the Blank Brothers,
Blank,
right?
Blank Chester Brothers.
Heaven. Yeah. Oh, sorry.
yes.
Okay. Heaven Can Wait.
Yeah.
Blank's preference of her lesbianism quickly gets around the precinct, which gives her mixed reactions. Meanwhile, Blank clashes with Simone throughout their investigation of the senseless murder of two kids, which is only the start of a really bad day. The Simone is a clue there.
Yeah, Blank and Simone is your best clue in the middle there.
Oh, well, I will say Prime Suspect, the American version.
Tara, you know it then?
I think Sarah knows it too, probably. NYPD Blue.
That is correct. All right, last question to round three for Tara. The heavens can wait.
Uh-huh.
The ER is flooded with teenagers poisoned by an unknown rave drug. Blank and Blank are hit by a drunk driver, and Blank's injury ruin her chances at NASA.
Is this ER?
No, it's ER's contemporary show. Chicago Hope.
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, that thing.
All right, that's round three.
Oh, right, NASA. I forgot that was a thing. Well, the scores have not changed. Still.
Oh, Jesus.
Two for Sarah, two for Jeff, three for me.
Round four, Bad Moon Rising. Bad Moon Rising, Sarah D. Bunting. While interacting with Blank, Tyler discreetly looks for his part in Dark Family Secrets. After breaking up at a party at the swimming hole, Blank makes the shift in the basement of the old Lockwood property. Blank follows him into the basement ruins. That makes no sense.
Tyler and Lockwood.
Blank makes the shift in the basement of the old Lockwood property. That might mean something in the context of the show. I cannot help you, however, with that information, for I've never watched it.
Well, that's a hint.
Yes, a show I've never watched.
It's not Ancient Aliens.
Nope.
Okay, thank you. It's not MacGyver. That's good. Let's try True Blood.
Wow. Vampire Diaries.
Oh, damn it.
Makes the shift in the basement. I don't know what that means.
I don't know.
Bad Moon Rising, Jeff Drake.
All right.
As a full moon hangs over the city, the rookies are unnerved by a series of strange occurrences. While investigating the theft of three severed heads from a medical lab, Blank and Blank pick up the trail of a mentally unstable man who has stopped taking his medication. Additional hint, not Night Court.
I'm going to say Rookie Blue.
I love it.
Wow.
Tara Ariano.
Yep.
Bad Moon Rising.
Mm-hmm.
Blank talks to a lawyer about the concealment of his blank. Blank and blanks spar over a financial bailout of Mexico. Going to give you one of the blanks.
Of his blank.
Of his concealment of his, oh, good choice.
Yeah.
MS.
Oh, The West Wing.
Bad Moon Rising, Sarah Ariano. After blank attacks him with a stake, blank is hospitalized, and blank refuses to pass over in order to stay with him. Two vampires come to the hospital, but blank, helped by a nervous chaplain, sees them off, and the dying Josie sacrifices herself by donating her blood to cure blank. That's five blanks. I think I can give you a blank.
I'll take the first blank.
After Herrick attacks him with a stake. Herrick.
If this is true blood, I'm going to kill myself, but that's not my guess. I'm going to go with Penny Dreadful.
It was True Blood?
No, it was not True Blood. Oh. I believe this is a British show remade here. Being Human.
Being Human, sure.
Yeah.
Stakes!
Bad Moon.
Stakes!
Bad Moon Rising, Jeff Drake. It's that time of month for blank, and blank walks on eggshells to avoid the mood swings. Encouraged by blank and friends, blank buys pills that are supposed to help her mood. Got to give you a blank on this one. That's five blanks.
I'm going to take the second blank.
It's that time of month for blank, and Ray walks on eggshells to avoid the mood swings.
It's not what I thought it was going to be at all.
No, me either.
Wait, additional hint. Additional hint for you, Jeff Drake. One of my best, according to the internet, and favorite impressions.
Go.
Everybody loves Raymond.
Deborah. Asterisk. Nobody says that. Terrible impression. Tara Ariano.
Mm-hmm.
Blank explains to blank about the feral Coyote prison gang. And they find an old friend of Hank is actually the one who fled his pack years ago and now finds his daughter kidnapped.
Is this True Blood? I don't know what other show has werewolves.
That is Grimm.
Oh, of course.
Oh, Jesus.
That was round four.
All right. Sarah has two. Jeff and I are tied with four each.
God. Vampires.
Round five, burning down the house. Sarah D. Bunting, when blank and blank find an old joint in the gym's lost and found box, they decide to make a night of it.
How is
when
that possible?
Blank and his colleagues, Tom, stops by. Blank coerces Tom into going to buy some more pot. I'll give you a blank.
Can I have the first blank, please?
When Barb and blank find an old joint in the gym's lost and found box.
Okay, that's really not where I thought that was going. At all.
This is your mom's show.
Yeah. Now I don't. Now I don't have any idea where it's going, Benson.
The second one was Christine. That's the old adventure, the new adventures of old Christine.
Yes.
Burning down the house, Jeff Drake, blank's mother comes for a visit and delivers some surprising news. Blank builds a catapult. Blank discovers someone's secret identity. Correction, blank builds a trebuchet. That's my edit to this IMDb, I'm assuming, synopsis.
They are not the same.
They are not the same. Can I get the whole clue again?
Blank's mother comes for a visit and delivers some surprising news. Blank builds a trebuchet. Blank discovers someone's secret identity.
Wow. The Tick.
Anybody?
No.
That's Northern Exposure.
Oh, Trebuchet.
Oh, I remember that episode.
Northern Exposure.
That's
and for
right.
the other five people
that.
Who watched Canadian hockey soap MVP, there was a character, like this Keanu-looking kid named Damon Trebuchet.
Oh, boy.
Burning down the house, Tara Ariano, blank blames blank after her house burns down, apparently as the result of a gift given to blank by his uncle. Blank starts a change machine business. Change machine business.
Can I get a blank?
Yeah, you can, because there's four.
Blank. Yep.
Mimi.
The Drew Carey Show.
Correct.
Solid.
Burning down the house, Sarah D. Bunting, blank and blank investigate a warehouse fire in which a fireman, Craig Hill, was killed. Blank finds that the fire likely started from a heater that had been tampered with. The building was a denim factory, and the owner, Arnold Whistler, that seems like a lot of information for a synopsis, had a number of sexual harassment lawsuits filed against him. Pick a blank.
The first one, please.
All right. Jane. Jane.
Oh, I was hoping it was going to be vampire.
No, Angel. Jane and blank investigate. Is this the American Prime Suspect?
This is Rizzoli and Isles.
No.
Burning down the house. Jeff Drake. As
yes.
all hell breaks loose, blank summons her most potent powers yet to save blank. Jesus tries to breach the Moon Goddess Emporium's defenses to liberate blank.
Might be Jesus.
Oh, yeah. Okay. But it might not be, frankly.
But it might not. I don't know.
I don't watch the show.
It can happen at the Moon Emporium. I've said it a million times.
Tries to breach the Moon Goddesses. I mean, it could be either one, right?
It could, sure.
Listen
I don't
to
know.
That description.
Say it again, please.
Okay. All hell breaks loose. Blank summons her most potent powers yet to save blank. Jesus slash Jesus tries to breach the Moon Goddess Emporium's defenses in order to liberate blank.
Is this True Blood?
Finally, it is.
Yay!
All right, let's end round five. Burning down the house, Tara Ariano.
Yes.
Blank wants to throw a small, classy party, but blank ruins it by inviting everyone. Things get even worse when he accidentally sets her house on fire. And here's a good clue. This is a repeat show.
Oh.
I know you might be thinking that doesn't happen, but
okay.
It is happening.
Sure. Dawson's Creek. Shit.
That 70s show.
Oh,
those
sure.
fuckers.
All right. Sarah has two. Jeff and I each have...
What was that number?
Five.
Thank you. Sympathy for the Devil. Sarah D. Bunting, fine. Blank and Blank, really worried that Blank might be injured at Smashball. Although he scores well and Owen protects him, even against the most feared adversaries. Blank and Blank really worry that Blank might be injured at Smashball. Smashball.
Uh-huh. Futurama?
Ha.
Good guess.
Yeah, I can see why you guessed that. But
it's a really good guess.
Get this. One Tree Hill.
What?
Yeah, Smashball.
Okay.
All right. Isn't
Smashball?
What? Is it Smashball that basketball trampoline game?
That was
Slam Ball. Sympathy for the Devil, Jeff Drake. Blank is back to work where she meets meticulous Dr. Patrick Curtis, with whom she argues. Blank puts his life in danger for the sake of his patient. Blank takes an important decision regarding his family life. Additional hint, already a show in this game.
Chicago Hope.
Saving Hope.
Damn it!
Tara Ariano, Sympathy for the Devil. Blank refuses to let a death row inmate die from injuries sustained in a prison riot. Blank refuses to let a little boy die because he can't get the badly needed transplant. Blank refuses to let his relationship with Blank die. Blank won't let her budding relationship with Blank die. And Blank's visiting mother puts everyone's mother first on priority lists.
Oh, Christ.
Okay, so...
I'll just give me the first blank.
Derek.
Grey's Anatomy.
Sarah Bunting, when a woman recently found innocent of her child's murder by Judge Joan Hunt is killed, blank and her staff must find who did it. A sensationalistic reporter impedes their progress. Meanwhile, because of the controversy surrounding the case, Judge Hunt is voted out of office. Only one blank.
I hate that Judge Hunt. She's such a, well, you know.
Any idea what that show is?
Blank and her staff. Bones.
Bones is incorrect. That was Body of Proof. Body of Proof. Good luck with that one, and good luck with the next one, and the next one after that.
Oh, great.
I'm just going to end the round here. All right, that is round six. The answers were Body of Proof, Battle Creek, and La Femme Nikita. I didn't have any...
Zero chance.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then, Sarah has two. Jeff has five. I have six.
All right. Getting towards the end. Round seven. Someone to watch over me. Sarah D. Bunting. As the heat is turned up on suspicions surrounding Spencer, the blanks must come to the harsh realization that they are not the only ones hiding secrets in Rosewood.
Rosewood?
I understand why you would guess that. That is, in fact, Pretty Little Liars.
Okay.
Jeff Drake blank makes first contact with the Kadi, a ritualistic race with many social protocols. Blank takes the advice of the captain, and the doctor gives her classes in dating.
Star Trek Voyager.
You are correct. Someone to watch over me, Tara.
Yep.
Blank is in the hospital and wants visitors. Not getting any, he hires his actors to be his parents. Meanwhile, neighbors accuse Dreyfus of fathering their dog puppies.
Oh, Dreyfus. Empty nest?
Oh,
jeez.
Wow.
Nice one.
Someone to watch over me, Sarah Bunting. The murder of an upstairs neighbor puts his daughter at risk, and Blank's family history seems to get in the way of helping her. Meanwhile, Garrett and Lily are at odds on how to handle a case that involves a powerful man who will stop at nothing to hide the truth. Before you answer, I'm going to give you a hint, because it's hint day. Law and Order adjacent, thanks to casting.
I that doesn't help, I'm afraid. Leverage, I don't know.
That is Crossing Jordan. Crossing Jordan.
Oh, right. Okay.
Someone to watch over me, Jeff Drake. Blank becomes increasingly paranoid when it appears that one of his callers is stalking him. He hires a bodyguard to accompany him to the CB Awards, S-E-A-B-E-A Awards.
Frasier.
That is good for a point.
Nice.
Tara Ariano.
Yes.
Someone to watch over me.
Okay.
Blank meets a pianist who reminds her of her father. She tries to play a melody she remembers from her childhood, and a drawing made by Blank helps her. Meanwhile, Blank is to be tried for treason. Blank takes her side and helps her escape. That's four blanks, so pick a blank.
First.
Kara.
Battlestar Galactica.
Good.
Okay. Sarah has two. Jeff has seven. I have eight.
Two, seven, eight. We got two rounds left, guys. Suspicious Minds. Sarah, an undercover cop is killed by the crime boss he was investigating. The deaf daughter of an Elvis impersonator saw the murder and is now in danger from the killer. No blanks.
The deaf daughter of an Elvis impersonator.
Yeah, saw the murder and is now in danger from the killer.
Shit.
That's amazing. Okay, wait, I'm gonna give you a hint.
Okay.
Sarah's at two, right?
Yeah.
The title of the show contains one of the 50 states in the United States of America.
New York Undercover.
Oh, okay. Also contains a comma. Also contains Chuck Norris. That is, yes, Dave, Walker, Texas Ranger. Suspicious Minds. Jeff Drake blank decides to organize a glamorous Halston fashion show. Halston fashion show. Blank and blank are now at odds with each other on how to punish Andrew. Oh, God damn it, Andrew. The police investigate the skeletal body in a toy chest that blank dumped in the river and begin to close in on his secret. 1, 2, 3, 4 blanks. Pick a blank.
First one.
All right. Gabrielle decides to organize a glamorous Halston fashion show.
Desperate Housewives.
You are correct.
Well done.
Nice.
Blank is Blank's campaign manager, Tara. Mm-hmm. Blank thinks that she is pregnant and takes a test kit from the store without paying. Blank pretends he meant to buy it. It causes a problem for the campaign for blanks. You know what that means? Pick a blank.
I think I know this one.
Okay.
Oh, wait. I'm not going to get cocky. I'll take the first blank.
Lemon.
Lemon. Oh, Heart of Dixie?
Not what you were thinking?
Holy
no, I was going to say Veep.
I was going to say Degrassi.
Sure.
Sarah D. Bunting. In the 2-hour season finale, Blank's pending promotion to replace Blank as vice president of D&D. Even I know this one.
I'm good. Melrose Place.
I was going to say, all you really need is D&D.
I was going to say, that's what I remember, D&D. And I'm not quite sure. Jeff Drake, Blank faces further backlash from the FBI when he helps former Navy intelligence analyst Blank, who is the lead suspect in a multiple homicide case.
NCIS?
Is that the full answer? NCIS yes. New Orleans. New Orleans.
Oh,
navally.
I forgot to say it in my Creole accent. Sorry. for a class project.
Yeah.
Tara Ariana.
Yep.
Students are paired up as married couples. Blank is partnered with Blank, making Blank jealous. And when she decides to have Blank, now a private detective, spy on them, he plots to break them up for Blanks.
Making Blank jealous.
Sabrina. Oh, Tara, you guessed the right one, I think.
Sabrina the Teenage Witch.
Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Our last round is coming up.
Oh, well, Sarah has 3. Jeff has 8. I have 10.
All right. Everybody's got 2. So Tara can clinch it with a right answer. Jeff needs both his answers to force a tie. The kids are all right. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yes.
Still missing Henry, Blank fights her attraction to Geo.
To Geo?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Joe.
Yeah. And Geo was his name. Oh, I don't know. Once Upon a Time.
Tara, you used to watch this show. Do you know what it is?
No.
It's Ugly Betty, Dave. Yes, thank
you.
Oh, wow.
All right. The kids are all right. Jeff, pressure's on.
Yeah.
A strange death reported in the newspaper prompts Blank and Blank to find Lisa Braden, a woman Blank had a weekend fling with about approximately 8.7 years ago, only to find she has a son turning 8. And let me just remind you, we've got Blank and Blank, and we have a repeating show.
Oh. Supernatural?
Nice.
The kids are all right, Tara, reminding you of repeating shows.
Okay.
Blank and Blank slept together in her bed and are caught by Blank. Blank wearing briefs and her top. Strangely enough, also in her closet was Blank, while his new wife, Lori, is on honeymoon with her friend, Carlos. 5 blanks. Pick a blank.
First blank.
Eric.
True Blood.
Eric from That 70s Show.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
That 70s show was all over this thing.
Well, you know, songs, 70s, makes sense that they would do that.
Yeah.
The kids are all right, Sarah D. Bunting. During the summer, Blank and Blank rocked Los Angeles and spent time with her next-door neighbors, the Osbournes, and Jack Osborne even tags along with them to interview at Worthington. Blank spent her time in New York and got ecstatic to learn her parents are separating.
Keeping Up with the Kardashians?
Oh. It's Dawson's Creek, right?
Yeah, it's Dawson's Creek. During the summer,
Worthington,
Pacey and Audrey walked Los Angeles and spent time with her next door neighbors, the Osbournes. Yeah, yeah. That sounds like Dawson's Creek.
I was out by that time.
Jeff Drake, the pressure is further on. Here's the pressure being further on. As blank's plan to keep blank from being tried threatens to unravel, an unexpected reunion with blank pits blank against two hitmen working for a ruthless Memphis drug lord. Four blanks, pick a blank.
First blank.
As Boyd's plan to keep blank from being tried threatens to unravel. An unexpected reunion with blank pits blank against two hitmen working for a ruthless Memphis drug lord. What's that show?
Justified.
All right.
That is.
Nice. All right, Tara, all comes down to this.
Okay.
You get it right, you're the winner. You get it wrong, we're in a tiebreaker situation.
Okay.
A former associate of blank's father, Russell, along with his daughter, Raina, mm-hmm. returns to town with some unfinished business for our crew.
I don't know. Gossip Girl.
That clinches it.
What? Oh, nice.
Wow.
Tara.
Was that just a total guess?
Yeah.
All right.
I just remembered Arena from a show, yeah.
Arena?
Yeah.
That is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We chewed the fat about the Charleston season of Top Chef before discovering why Dave is not a crackpot for insisting that house hunting shows feature people actually buying a house. Then we went around the dial with stops at Divorce, Fleabag, and Pitch, and then decided that the Sopranos Funhouse will sleep with the fishes of the Extra Hot Great canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariana.
Seriously, though, where are the biscuits?
Sarah D. Bunting.
This is really underseasoned.
And Jeff Drake.
Chicken Vindaloo.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Oh, farts.
Time's up. Hands up. Utensils down, everyone.
Nice.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.